issues a caution and demands accountability. There's a lot more about this to come in our final chapter. Let's talk about sympathy, because empathy is not sympathy. In fact, using the near enemy concept, we can definitely consider sympathy the near enemy of empathy. Rather than being a tool for connection, sympathy emerged in the data as a form of disconnection. Sympathy is removed when someone says, "I feel sorry for you," or "That must be terrible." They're standing at a safe distance. Rather than conveying the powerful "me too" of empathy, it communicates, "Not me," then adds, "But I do feel sorry for you." Sympathy can even be a trigger for shame, which we'll discuss in the next chapter. Researchers found that cancer patients on the receiving end of sympathy describe it as an unwanted, superficial, pity-based response that, although well-intended, is focused on the observer's discomfort rather than on alleviating the patient's distress. Patients prefer empathic and compassionate responses from others, seeing these responses as more helpful and more genuine than sympathy responses. Sympathy and pity are first cousins. They're the emotions of, "We feel bad for you," from way over here where that kind of misery you're experiencing doesn't happen. Lulu Wang, the writer and director of one of my favorite films, The Farewell, tweeted, "Let's be clear, empathy and pity are not the same thing. When non-people of color, non-female people tell our stories, they may think that they're creating empathy, but they unconsciously channel pity, which can often look like empathy, but it's not. The difference is hierarchy." This is one reason we need to dispel the myth that empathy is walking in someone else's shoes. Rather than walking in your shoes, I need to learn how to listen to the story you tell me about what it's like in your shoes and believe you, even when it doesn't match my experience. The minute I try to put myself in your place rather than try to understand the situation from your perspective, our empathic connection unravels. Either I get sucked into the vortex of my own emotional difficulties, or because my experience doesn't match yours, I doubt what you're telling me. We see this empathic miss all the time when we share our experiences with people whose identities afford them more physical, social, and emotional safety. You know, if someone shares something with me about their experience in a meeting and I come back and say, "You know, I'm imagining that not being called on in a meeting is really not so painful," says the man to the woman who's often overlooked, or the white woman to the black woman who's routinely ignored, versus hearing what that experience felt like for the person sharing the story and responding by saying, "Oh, feeling invisible is painful." I also want to talk about the concept of compassion fatigue. This is a term used to refer to the emotional exhaustion or burnout that can occur among caregivers. The term comes up most frequently in research focusing on medical professionals, but is also used as related to other clinical professions, psychologists, therapists, social workers, and non-clinical service professions like customer service, teachers. There's compelling research that shows that compassion fatigue occurs when caregivers focus on their own personal distress reaction rather than on the experience of the person they're caring for. Focusing on one's own emotional reaction results in an inability to respond empathically to the person in need. In this view, the more appropriate term, rather than compassion fatigue, might be empathic distress fatigue. We're not hearing the story, we're inserting ourselves in the story. Last, the number one question I get when I'm teaching empathy is, how can I be empathic with someone if I haven't had their experience? It's a great question because it exposes a very dangerous myth about empathy. Empathy is not relating to an experience. It's connecting to what someone is feeling about an experience. When I'm working with groups, I often ask participants to raise their hands if they know joy, hurt, heartbreak, shame, grief, love, etc. At the end, after all of the hands have been raised to every emotion, I say, you're qualified. You don't need to be the expert or experience what they've experienced. You need to connect to your own experiences in a thinking way that creates emotional resonance. Oh yeah, I know that feeling. I'm not going to fall into it right now, but I know it and I can communicate with you in a way that makes you know that you're not alone. Before we leave this section on empathy, and we've just talked about sympathy, I want to go through some more of the empathy misses. These are when we fall short in our effort to be empathic, and it's also, we probably all know what it feels like to have someone respond to our struggle with these. It's really tough. The thing to remember as I'm going through these 8 empathy misses is that not only have we experienced them as people looking for empathy, we've probably done them ourselves. We are, you know, we've been on both sides. So let's look at them. Let's go through all 8. So the first one we've already talked about a little bit, that's sympathy versus empathy. That's a really big empathy miss. Again, it's that person who responds with, I feel so sorry for you, rather than, I get it, I feel with you, I've been there. The subtext of this response is distance. These things don't happen to me or people like me. Let me tell you for sure, if you want to see a shame cyclone turn deadly, throw one of these at it. Aw, you poor thing, or bless your heart. The second empathy miss is judgment. This is kind of, you should feel shame. You should feel bad. This is the person who hears the story and actually feels shame for you. The friend gasps and confirms how horrified you should be. Then there's this awkward silence. Then you have to make this person feel better by convincing them that you're not a terrible person. The third empathy miss is disappointment. You share something hard and all of a sudden you're facing someone that is looking at you like, you've let me down. This is the person who needs you to be a pillar of worthiness and authenticity, and they can't help you or be connected with you right now during this time of struggle because they're too disappointed in your imperfection. You know, you've let them down. Another empathy miss is discharging discomfort with blame. This is when you share something hard that's going on and the person across from you is thinking, God, this feels terrible. Who can we blame? Including, like, can we blame you? Now, because shame is visceral and contagious, we can feel it for other people. This person immediately needs to discharge the discomfort and vulnerability of the situation that you're explaining to them by blaming and scolding. They can blame and scold you. You know, what were you thinking? Or they can look for someone else to take the fall. Who was that guy? Who said that to you? We'll kick his ass. You know, one thing I will tell you, a caution, is parents can easily fall into this when a child shares something difficult with them, like a shaming story. Instead of listening and connecting to the pain the child's in, we can often come back immediately with, how did you let this happen? What do you mean you didn't turn in your homework? What do you mean you talked while the teacher was talking? That's a real missed opportunity for connection. The fifth one is kind of, let's just make this go away. This is where we hear a struggle and we just try to minimize and avoid. We want everything, the hard stuff to go away. Out of our own discomfort, sometimes we refuse to acknowledge that someone else is in pain or that they're hurting. We think, oh my God, you're exaggerating. It couldn't have been that bad. You're awesome. You're perfect. You rock. Everyone loves you. This is definitely a case of, I want this to go away because I'm too uncomfortable. The next one is comparing and competing. And this is hard. This is when we confuse connecting around liked emotion with competing. So I share something hard that's happened with someone and their response is, oh my God, that's nothing. Listen to what happened to me one time. And so now we're in like suffering comparison or the one-upping of misery. The seventh one is, I call it speaking truth to power. And this is when we share something difficult with someone and they respond by basically saying, you should have kept your head down and your mouth shut. Let's say that I hold someone accountable for some kind of language or comment or behavior that marginalizes or dehumanizes someone. and it causes a conflict. When I tell someone this story, instead of, you know, responding with empathy and like, God, that must have been hard, they respond with, I can't believe you said that to your boss. I can't believe you went there. You can't talk about that kind of stuff. Versus, you know, God, that must have been hard. That took some courage. Or, hey, it's difficult these days to stand up for what you believe in. They're almost freaked out because you stood up for something. The last one, which is maybe the most common, is advice giving and problem solving is a huge empathy miss. Sometimes when we see pain, our first instinct is to fix it. And this is especially true for those of us who, you know, the value we add often is that we're great problem solvers. And so in these instances, rather than listening and being with people in their emotion, we try to fix it. I can fix this and I can fix you. So again, the big eight empathy misses, sympathy versus empathy, judgment, disappointment, discharging discomfort with blame, minimizing and avoiding, comparing and competing, speaking truth to power, and advice giving. We have two more emotions and experiences to cover in this chapter. Next for us is boundaries, one of my favorite topics, hard to set, beautiful to live by. Boundaries are actually a prerequisite for compassion and empathy. We can't connect with someone unless we're clear about where we end and they begin. If there's no autonomy between people, then there's actually no compassion or empathy. It's just enmeshment. How can you give to someone? How can you help? How can you be present for or connected to if you're just one unit? There has to be autonomy and separation. This has probably been one of the most significant soul-shaking learnings of my career. In fact, for a couple of years, it made no sense at all to me. Why did all of the compassion practitioners, therapists, counselors, monks that I've interviewed talk about the importance of boundaries? Why did the lack of boundaries and judgment seem to go hand in hand in the data? In The Gifts of Imperfection, I write, the heart of compassion is really acceptance. The better we are at accepting ourselves and others, the more compassionate we become. Well, it's difficult to accept people when they are hurting us or taking advantage of us or walking all over us. This research has taught me that if we really want to practice compassion, we have to start by setting boundaries and holding people accountable for their behavior. I was recently struggling with a boundary issue. Yes, I still struggle with boundary issues, even though I research them and study them and have been writing about them for over a decade. It's like a muscle. You have to work it all the time. Otherwise, it goes away. And so I was working on a boundary issue, and I told my therapist that I refuse to go back to being overly sweet or saccharine. Before I really understood how impossible it is to be compassionate to myself or to others when people are taking advantage of me, and when I used to prioritize being liked over being free, I was much sweeter than I am now, but I was so less authentic. Now I think I'm kinder, but less judgmental, but I'm also firmer and more solid. On occasion, salty. I can definitely be salty. The best definition of boundary still comes from my friend Kelly Ray Roberts. Kelly Ray was an oncology social worker who followed her dreams and became a prolific, globally recognized artist. After experiences with some of her art students copying her work and selling it, she addressed her art community with a very straightforward blog post on, this was the title, what's okay and what's not okay in terms of using her images. For example, it's okay to be inspired by her work, but not okay to copy it and sell it. This is a simple but profound way to set boundaries. As we say in our organization, clear is kind, unclear is unkind. Too often we forget about the what is okay part, and that leads to unnecessary disconnection. When people set a boundary with us, we can feel that they're denying us our right to our own thinking and feeling. When we explain up front what's okay, we move the focus to where it belongs. This expression of your feeling or thinking is the problem. It's okay to be pissed. It's not okay to raise your voice and pound on the table. It's okay to change your mind. It's not okay to assume that I'm okay with the changes without talking to me. It's okay to want to be able to do the things your friends are allowed to do. I totally get that. What's not okay is breaking our family rules to do them. It's okay to disagree with me, but it's not okay to ridicule my ideas or my beliefs. Before we leave boundaries, I want to share, I think, what is one of the most profound and beautiful quotes on boundaries from someone we'll hear about later in the book, an embodiment practitioner, counselor, organizer, Prentice Hemphill. Prentice writes, "Boundaries are the distance at which I can love you and me simultaneously." Okay, last topic in this chapter is comparative suffering. The thing that we have to understand, and this is really hard in the world today, is that empathy is not finite and compassion is not a pizza with 8 slices. When we practice empathy and compassion with someone, there's not less of these qualities to go around. There's actually more. Love is the last thing we need to ration in this world. But fear and scarcity trigger comparison, and even pain and hurt are not immune to being assessed and ranked. Because COVID unleashed such massive fear and anxiety, we saw comparative suffering everywhere. My husband died, and that grief is worse than your grief over missing your daughter's wedding. I'm not allowed to talk about how disappointed I am about my job changing because my friend just found out that his wife has COVID. You're worried about your teenager becoming disconnected and isolated during quarantine when thousands and thousands of people are dying in India? What we fail to understand is that the family in India doesn't benefit more if you conserve your concern only for them and withhold it from your child who's also suffering. Yes, perspective is critical, but I'm a firm believer that sharing how we feel, even complaining, is okay as long as we piss and moan with a little perspective. Hurt is hurt, and every time we honor our own struggle and the struggle of others, by responding with empathy and compassion, the healing that results affects all of us. Chapter 8, Places We Go When We Fall Short. Shame, self-compassion, perfectionism, guilt, humiliation, and embarrassment. I came across a quote the other day that read, "Science is not the truth. Science is finding the truth. When science changes its opinion, it didn't lie to you. It learned more." The first thing I thought of when I read that quote was this section of the book. If you're familiar with any of my work, you know that I've been researching and writing on shame, guilt, humiliation, and embarrassment for more than 20 years. Over these 2 decades, we've learned more about how these emotions work, and researchers have come up with innovative ways of measuring them. But nothing has fundamentally shifted my thinking on them until recently. New research on the connection between humiliation and violence has completely changed the way I think about that emotion and reinforced my belief that shame and humiliation will never be effective social justice tools. We're going to talk about these 4 terms together because we have the tendency to use them interchangeably, even though the experiences are very different in terms of biology, biography, behavior, and backstory, and self-talk. And they lead to radically different outcomes. We're also going to talk about the important role self-compassion plays in moving through shame and how perfectionism is a function of shame. Let's start with some short definitions and examples to differentiate the 4 emotions. Then we'll dig deeper into each one. Shame. Easiest way to think about it, I am bad. The focus is on self, not behavior. The result is feeling flawed and unworthy of love, belonging, and connection. Shame is not a driver of positive change. So an example of shame, you get back a quiz and your grade is F. Your self-talk, the way you talk to yourself about this grade, is, I'm so stupid. Let's compare shame with guilt. So guilt is not, I am bad, but I did something bad. The focus is on behavior. Guilt is the discomfort we feel when we evaluate what we've done or failed to do against our own values. It actually can drive positive change and behavior. So same example, you get back that quiz, your grade's an F. Instead of saying, I'm so stupid, which is the shame self-talk, your self-talk is, ugh, going to the party instead of studying for this quiz was so stupid. Again, the focus is on the behavior, not yourself. Humiliation is, I've been belittled and put down by someone. This left me feeling unworthy of connection and disgusted with myself. I believe this was unfair and I didn't deserve this. With shame, we believe that we deserve our sense of unworthiness. With humiliation, we don't feel like we deserved it. So let's say the student sitting next to you sees the F at the top of your quiz and tells the class, oh my God, this idiot can't even pass a quiz in here. He's as stupid as they come. Everyone laughs and you feel dumb and enraged. Embarrassment is, I did something that made me feel uncomfortable, but I know I'm not alone. Everyone does these kinds of things. Embarrassment is fleeting and sometimes funny. So your teacher's handing out quizzes and you come back from the bathroom with toilet paper stuck to your shoe. Shame, I am bad. Guilt, I'm a good person, but I did something bad. Humiliation, I've been put down, I didn't deserve it, and I'm enraged and hurt. And embarrassment, fleeting, funny, I've done something uncomfortable, but I know other people have done it. So let's dig into each one of these four emotions, starting with shame. I start this section on shame with a quote from the book Finding Fish by Antoine Quentin Fisher. He writes, I hated the internal wounds, the words that said I was worthless and unwanted, the teasing, the ridicule that echoed in my ears and shattered my insides into dust. If given the choice, I'd have picked a beating over being shamed. Reading Antoine Fisher's book, Finding Fish, was a sliding doors moment for me. I had just started researching shame and I was getting pushback from every direction. Everyone thought it was too difficult a topic to study. There were very few research articles on shame 20 years ago, and the first one I found warned that the decision to study shame had been the death of many academic careers. I devoured Finding Fish right when it came out. Fisher writes about shame with such haunting detail that it solidified my decision to study this emotion that we all experience and all hate talking about. So here are my shame 1-2-3s. One, we all have it. Shame is universal and one of the most primitive emotions that we experience. The only people who don't experience shame are those who really lack the capacity for empathy and even human connection. Number two, we're all afraid to talk about it. Sometimes we can feel shame just when we say the word shame, but it's getting easier, I think, definitely from the time I started. It's getting easier because more people are talking about it and using the word. Number three, the less we talk about shame, the more control it has over us. Shame hates being spoken. When we hear the word shame, our first thought is either, I have no idea what that means and I do not want to know, or I know exactly what that means and I'm not going to talk about it. We can also make up that shame is something that happens to other people, not us. But shame is in all of us. Here are some examples shared by the research participants from our early study on shame. Shame is hiding the fact that I'm in recovery. Shame is raging at my kids. Shame is bankruptcy. Shame is getting laid off and having to tell my pregnant wife. Shame is my boss calling me an idiot in front of a client. Shame is not making partner. Shame is my husband leaving me for my next door neighbor. Shame is my partner asking me for a divorce and telling me that she wants children but not with me. Shame is my DUI. Shame is infertility. Shame is telling my fiance that my dad lives in France when, in fact, he's in prison. Shame is internet porn. Shame is flunking out of school twice. Shame is hearing my parents fight through the walls and wondering if I'm the only one who feels this afraid. Connection, along with love and belonging, which are two expressions of connection, is why we're here. It's what gives purpose and meaning to our lives. Shame is simply the fear of disconnection. It's the fear that something we've done or failed to do, an ideal that we have not lived up to, or a goal that we've not accomplished, somehow makes us unworthy of connection. Shame says, I'm unlovable, I don't belong. Here's the definition of shame that emerged from my research. Shame is the intensely painful feeling or experience of believing that we are flawed and therefore unworthy of love, belonging, and connection. Shame thrives on secrecy, silence, and judgment. If you put shame into a petri dish and douse it with these three things, secrecy, silence, and judgment, it will grow exponentially into every corner and crevice of our lives. The antidote to shame is empathy. If we reach out and share our shame experience with someone who responds with empathy, shame literally dissipates. Shame needs us to believe that we're alone. That's why empathy is a hostile environment for shame. Self-compassion also helps us move through shame, but we need empathy as well for an important reason. Shame is a social emotion. Shame happens between people and it heals between people. Even if I feel shame alone, it's still the way that I see myself through someone else's eyes. Self-compassion is often the first step to healing shame because we need to be kind to ourselves before we can share our stories with someone else. As I mentioned in the previous chapter, Kristen Neff's research on self-compassion has been a life changer for me. Neff runs the Center for Mindful Self-Compassion, where she studies how we develop and practice self-compassion. According to Neff, self-compassion has three elements: self-kindness, common humanity, and mindfulness. This is how she describes them. So self-kindness versus self-judgment. Self-compassion entails being warm and understanding toward ourselves when we suffer, fail, or feel inadequate, rather than ignoring our pain or flagellating ourselves with self-criticism. Self-compassionate people recognize that being imperfect, failing, and experiencing life difficulties, it's inevitable. So they tend to be gentle with themselves when confronted with painful experiences, rather than getting angry when life falls short of set ideals. Number two, common humanity versus isolation. Neff explains that self-compassion involves recognizing that suffering and personal inadequacy is part of the shared human experience, something that we all go through, rather than being something that happens to me alone. The last one is mindfulness versus over-identification. So Neff defines mindfulness as a non-judgmental, receptive mind state in which one observes thoughts and feelings as they are without trying to suppress or deny them. We cannot ignore our pain and feel compassion for it at the same time. At the same time, mindfulness requires that we not over-identify with thoughts and feelings so that we're caught up and swept away by this negative reactivity. I highly, highly recommend that you take your self-compassion inventory at self-compassion.org. That's the website. So self-compassion.org. You can learn a lot about your strengths and your areas that need attention. Being a shame researcher for so many years, I'm so good at common humanity. Like, I've talked to so many thousands of people that I know that everything happens to everyone. Even though shame tries to say it's just you, I know we all struggle. Self-kindness is always my growth area when I take this test. Like most people, I talk to myself in ways that I would never talk to the people I love. I try to remind myself that if I wouldn't talk to Ellen or Charlie when they make a mistake or drop a ball in a certain way, I shouldn't talk to myself in that way. Self-kindness is both more difficult and, I believe, more revolutionary than we think. So while we're on shame, let's talk about the four elements of shame resilience. Across our research, the participants who could move through shame without sacrificing their values and authenticity shared four practices when overcoming shame. We reverse engineered how they worked through shame to come up with a process that all of us can use. These steps rarely happen in the order that I'm going to talk about them. They just need to all happen in order to develop the resilience. So the first one is recognizing shame and understanding triggers. Can you physically recognize when you're in the grip of shame? Can you name it and feel your way through it and figure out, wow, what messages and expectations just triggered this? This is why Neff's concept of mindfulness is so important. We can't pretend that shame's not happening, or at the same time, we can't get swept away with it. It's easy to get swept away by shame. The next one is practicing critical awareness. Can we reality check the messages and expectations that are driving shame? Are they realistic, attainable? Are they what you want to be, or are they the story that you make up about what everyone else needs from you or wants from you? The third one is reaching out. Are we owning our story of what's happening and sharing it? We can't experience empathy if we're not reaching out and talking about our shame experience with people. The last one is speaking shame. Are we talking about how we feel and asking for what we need? Again, remember, silence, secrecy, and judgment fuel shame. So the four elements of shame resilience, again, we got to learn how to recognize it in our bodies, understand what triggered it. We have to practice critical awareness. Most of us experience shame because we're comparing ourselves to unattainable expectations. We got to reach out and talk to people, and we have to name it and talk about it and ask for what we need. Let's talk about shame in the culture. One reason that we get so confused about the term shame and what it means is that we misuse it all the time. People throw around the word shameless when they see someone make a self-serving or unethical decision. They attribute unconscionable behavior to a lack of shame. This is just wrong. It's just completely wrong and also incredibly dangerous. As I write in Dare to Lead, shame is not the cure, it's the cause. Don't let what looks like a bloated ego and narcissism fool you into thinking that there's a lack of shame. Shame and fear are almost always driving unethical behavior. We're now seeing that shame often fuels narcissistic behavior. In fact, I define narcissism as the shame-based fear of being ordinary. Grandiosity and bluster are easy to assign to an overinflated ego. It's tough to get a glimpse of the fear and lack of self-worth that are actually behind the posturing and selfishness, because posturing leads to weaponizing hurt and turning it on people. The last thing that shame-driven people need is more shame. What they need is more accountability for their behavior and their lack of empathy. Yes, more shame just makes them more dangerous, gives them the opportunity to redirect attention to the shaming behavior. And weirdly, it can drum up support from others who are also looking for a way to discharge their own pain and are looking for an enemy to blame. Shame is not a compass for moral behavior. It's much more likely to drive destructive, hurtful, immoral, and self-aggrandizing behavior than it is to heal it. Why? Because, and this is so important, let's take a deep breath together. What makes shame dangerous is that where shame exists, empathy is almost always absent. The opposite of experiencing shame is experiencing empathy. The behavior that many of us find so egregious today is more about people being empathy-less, not shameless. Rhonda Deering is our senior director for research, and she has studied shame for decades and was one of my early heroes in this field. Her summary of how empathy and shame work together, or better said, do not work together, is incredibly helpful. Here's what Rhonda writes. Empathy is an other-focused emotion. It draws our attention outward toward the other person's experience. When we are truly practicing empathy, our attention is fully focused on the other person and trying to understand their experience. We only have thoughts of self in order to draw on how our experience can help us understand what the other person is going through. Shame is egocentric, self-involved. It draws our focus inward. Our only concern with others when we are feeling shame is to wonder how others are judging us. Shame and empathy are incompatible. When feeling shame, our inward focus overrides our ability to think about another person's experience. We become unable to offer empathy. We are incapable of processing information about the other person, unless that information specifically pertains to what they're thinking about us. So I think we need to go forward and think when we hear people say, oh, this person needs more shame or this person's shameless. Is it that we need more shame or is it that we need more empathy and accountability? So related to shame, and most people don't know this, is perfectionism. In fact, shame is the birthplace of perfectionism. Perfectionism is not striving to be our best or working toward excellence. Healthy striving is internally driven. Perfectionism is externally driven by a simple but potentially all-consuming question. What will people think? It may seem counterintuitive, but one of the biggest barriers to working toward mastery is perfectionism. In our leadership research, we've learned that achieving mastery requires curiosity and viewing mistakes and failures as opportunities for learning. Perfectionism kills curiosity by telling us that we have to know everything or we risk looking less than. Perfectionism tells us that our mistakes and failures are personal defects. So we either avoid trying new things or we barely recover every time we inevitably fall short. Papers by Paul Hewitt and colleagues and Simon Sherry and colleagues provide evidence that people with high levels of perfectionistic traits, one, are doomed to fail at meeting their own expectations and the expectations that they assume are held by others. Two, perceive themselves as consistently falling short of other people's expectations. Three, behave in ways that result in perceived and actual exclusion and rejection by others. And last, people with high levels of perfectionism feel socially disconnected and have actual fewer social connections. I write a lot about perfectionism across my books. I think it's a healthy dose of researcher heal thyself. I often call myself a recovering perfectionist and an aspiring good enoughist. In The Gifts of Imperfection, I explain how perfectionism emerged from our research. The definition that best fit the data is that perfectionism is a self-destructive and addictive belief system that fuels this primary thought. If I look perfect, live perfect, work perfectly, and do everything perfectly, I can avoid or minimize the painful feelings of shame, judgment, and blame. Perfectionism is not self-improvement. Perfectionism is, at its core, about trying to earn approval and acceptance. Most perfectionists were raised being praised for achievement and performance. Good grades, good manners, nice appearance, sport prowess, rule following, people pleasing. Somewhere along the way, we adopt this dangerous and debilitating belief system. I am what I accomplish and how well I accomplish it. Please, perfect, perform. Healthy striving is self-focused. How can I improve? Perfectionism is other-focused. What will they think? Understanding the difference between healthy striving and perfectionism is critical to laying down the shield and picking up your life. Research shows that perfectionism hampers success. In fact, it often sets you on the path to depression, anxiety, addiction, and life paralysis. Life paralysis refers to all of the opportunities we miss because we're too afraid to put out anything in the world that could be imperfect. It's also all of the dreams that we don't follow because of our deep fear of failing, making mistakes, and disappointing others. It's terrifying to risk when you're a perfectionist because your self-worth is on the line. As previously mentioned, perfectionism is a self-destructive and addictive belief system that we use to try to protect ourselves from feelings of shame, judgment, and blame. It's a 20-ton shield that we lug around thinking, hey, this will protect me, when in fact it's the thing that really prevents us from being seen and taking flight. Let me explain why I describe perfectionism as being both self-destructive and addictive. Perfectionism is self-destructive simply because there is no such thing as perfect. Perfection is an unattainable goal. Additionally, perfectionism is more about perception. We want to be perceived as perfect. Again, this is unattainable. There is no way to control perception regardless of how much time and energy we spend trying. Perfectionism is addictive because when we invariably do experience shame, judgment, and blame, we often believe it's because we weren't perfect enough. So rather than questioning the faulty logic of perfectionism, we become even more entrenched in our quest to live, look, and do everything just right. Feeling shamed, judged, and blamed, and the fear of these feelings, are realities of the human experience. Perfectionism actually increases the odds that we'll experience these painful emotions, and that often leads to self-blame. God, it's my fault. I'm feeling this way because I'm not good enough. So one way to understand shame and perfectionism is to understand guilt. So like shame, guilt is an emotion that we experience when we fall short of our own expectations or standards. However, with guilt, our focus is on having done something wrong and on doing something to set things right, like apologizing or changing a behavior. Remorse, a subset of guilt, is what we feel when we acknowledge that we have harmed another person, we feel bad about it, and we want to atone for our behavior. While shame is highly correlated with addiction, violence, aggression, depression, eating disorders, and bullying, guilt is negatively correlated with these outcomes. Empathy and guilt work together to create a force that is adaptive and powerful. This is why when we apologize for something we've done, when we make amends or change a behavior that doesn't align with our values, it's guilt, not shame, that's the driving force. We feel guilty when we hold something we've done or failed to do against our values and we find they don't match up. It's a psychologically uncomfortable feeling, but one that's helpful. It's the cognitive dissonance and the discomfort that drives meaningful change. Shame, however, corrodes the very part of us that believes that we can change and do better. Let's now look at humiliation. So remember, we're talking about shame, guilt, humiliation, and embarrassment. And I start this section on humiliation with a quote from Kofi Annan, the Ghanaian diplomat and Nobel Peace Prize recipient. He writes, "All the cruel and brutal things, even genocide, start with the humiliation of one individual." Based on the research, we define humiliation as the intensely painful feeling that we've been unjustly degraded, ridiculed, or put down, and that our identity has been demeaned or devalued. Humiliation is most similar to shame in that we feel fundamentally flawed. But the most relevant distinction is that humiliation arises because someone else pointed out our flaws, and we don't feel like we deserved it. The entire key to understanding humiliation is that when it happens to us, it feels unjust. Linda Hartling is the director of a global transdisciplinary group called Human Dignity and Humiliation Studies. They prefer to call themselves nurturers of dignity. Hartling and her colleagues describe humiliation as unjustified mistreatment that violates one's dignity and diminishes one's sense of worth as a human being. Until recently, I held the belief that humiliation, though detrimental, was a less dangerous emotional experience than shame. The reasoning behind that thinking, and what emerged from our data, was that we hide our shame because we think we deserve to feel that way. In other words, we buy into the messaging that we're not enough, where in contrast, when we feel humiliated, we think that we didn't deserve what happened to us. We don't deserve what made us feel this way. So in our interviews, participants seemed to not buy into the messaging that they were flawed as much as they did with shame. However, a collection of studies changed my mind. In 2003, Susan Harder and colleagues issued a report that examined the media profiles of 10 prominent school shooters between 1996 and 1999. Harder and her colleagues reported that, quote, "In every case, the shooter described how they had been ridiculed, taunted, teased, harassed, or bullied by peers because of their inadequate appearance, social, or athletic behavior, spurned by someone in whom they were romantically interested, or put down in front of other students by a teacher or school administrator. All events that led to profound humiliation." That report in turn prompted a series of studies by Jeff Ellison and Susan Harder that found links for peer rejection, humiliation, depression, and anger with both suicidal and homicidal ideation. Perhaps more important, their studies suggest that bullying alone does not lead to aggression. Instead, individuals who are bullied become violent specifically when feelings of humiliation accompany the bullying. I'm going to read this again because it's so freaking important. So this is a series of studies done by Jeff Ellison and Susan Harder. Their studies suggest that bullying alone does not lead to aggression. Instead, individuals who are bullied become violent, specifically when feelings of humiliation accompany the bullying. This finding has tremendous implications for how we think about bullying and how we help bullying survivors heal. And given that humiliation is often an attack against a social identity, ethnicity, race, sexual orientation, we must investigate what we're doing in organizational, community, and school cultures to foster safety, and what we're doing consciously or unconsciously that gives people permission to belittle others. And finally, the third article we discovered was by Linda Hartling, who ties together research from several areas to propose a model explaining how humiliation can lead to violence. Hartling suggests that humiliation can trigger a series of reactions, including social pain, decreased self-awareness, increased self-defeating behavior, and decreased self-regulation that ultimately lead to violence. Hartling and colleagues state that, quote, humiliation is not only the most underappreciated force in international relations, it may be the missing link in the search for root causes of political instability and violent conflict, perhaps the most toxic social dynamic of our age, end quote. This connection between humiliation and aggression and violence explains much of what we're seeing today, amplified by the reach of social media. Dehumanizing and humiliating others are becoming increasingly normalized along with violence. Now, rather than humiliating someone in front of a small group of people, we have the power to eviscerate someone in front of a global audience of strangers. I know that we all have deeply passionate political and cultural beliefs, but shame and humiliation will never be effective social justice tools. They are tools of oppression. I remember reading this quote from Elie Wiesel years ago, and now it's become a practice for me, even when I'm enraged or afraid. Never allow anyone to be humiliated in your presence. Now let's get to the last of the four self-conscious affects, embarrassment. So we've talked about shame, guilt, humiliation, and now embarrassment, which is a fleeting feeling of self-conscious discomfort in response to a minor incident that was witnessed by others. When looking back on embarrassing incidents, we are usually able to see them as kind of funny and something that could have happened to anyone. Researcher Roland Miller writes, embarrassment does not persist for long periods of time, lasting only a few minutes instead of hours or days, a point nicely illustrated by the unique physiological marker of embarrassment, the blush. I loved that. I loved how this researcher, Miller, says it doesn't last for a long time, and the illustration of that is the fact that we blush, and then it kind of goes away. When we feel embarrassed, we can feel exposed, flustered, and clumsy. But we tend to respond to our embarrassment in non-threatening ways, like using humor, saying we're sorry, or sometimes just moving on and not even acknowledging it. Those of us who are more sensitive about social norms and being accepted are more susceptible to embarrassment. Some research suggests that there are three types of events that can trigger embarrassment: committing a faux pas or social mistake, being the center of attention, and being in a sticky social situation. And just in case you're wondering, the secondhand embarrassment feeling is real. We can absolutely feel vicarious embarrassment when we see others in embarrassing situations, even complete strangers. If we know the person in the embarrassing situation, it's even worse. I will never forget the first time I felt that sensation. I was little and I was watching I Love Lucy reruns after school. And I'm not sure what crazy thing she was doing, but I thought I was going to die. I remember jumping up from the sofa and turning off the TV during the episode where Lucy and Ethel get jobs working on a conveyor belt at a chocolate factory. They couldn't keep up with the speed of the belt, so they started shoving chocolates in their mouths and down their shirts. Like, I literally couldn't take it. I went back to watch it when I was writing this, and I have to tell you that it still gets me. It still makes me so uncomfortable that I can't watch. And maybe that's what makes scenes like this one iconic. We don't watch them, we feel them. The last thing about embarrassment that we should talk about is, from the research, we know that embarrassment takes years to develop, and its emergence coincides with the self-conscious ability to understand what others may be thinking of us. If you've raised tweens or teens or been in their general vicinity, you know that they can often spend more time being embarrassed than not embarrassed. It's constant cringe when we first start seeing ourselves through others' eyes, and it stays that way until we get into midlife and fall apart before we realize it just takes too much energy to try to manage perception. Chapter 9, Places We Go When We Search for Connection. Belonging, fitting in, connection, disconnection, insecurity, invisibility, and loneliness. Let's start with belonging and fitting in. We have to belong to ourselves as much as we need to belong to others. Any belonging that asks us to betray ourselves is not true belonging. Any discussion of belonging has to start with acknowledging that love and belonging are irreducible needs for all people. In the absence of love and belonging, there's always suffering. Have you ever seen that pyramid that's Maslow's hierarchy of needs? You know, you've got on the bottom the physiological needs, just what our body needs to survive. Then we have safety. In the middle is love and belonging. Then on top of that is esteem. And on the very top of the pyramid is self-actualization. Expanding on Maslow's hierarchy of needs, recent research shows that finding a sense of belonging in close social relationships and with our community is essential to well-being. What makes belonging essential for us is the fact that we are a social species. We can't survive without one another. Although I started my career studying connection, shame, and vulnerability, the topic of belonging has always emerged in the data. You can't study the emotions and experiences that define what it means to be human without constantly bumping into belonging. It's just too primal. In 2017, I published Braving the Wilderness, The Quest for True Belonging and the Courage to Stand Alone. It's a book about what it means to belong in this increasingly divisive and disconnected world. As a grounded theory researcher, my job is to understand what we call the main concern of study participants. For Braving the Wilderness, I approached the research with these broad questions. When it comes to belonging, what are people trying to achieve or feel? What are they concerned about? Here's how I explain the findings that emerged in Braving the Wilderness. We want to be a part of something. We want to experience real connection with others. But participants talked about not wanting to do that at the cost of their authenticity, freedom, or power. They talked about feeling surrounded by us versus them cultures that create feelings of spiritual disconnection. When I dug deeper into what they meant by spiritually disconnected, the research participants described a diminishing sense of shared humanity. Over and over, participants talked about their concern that the only thing that binds us together now is shared fear and disdain, not common humanity, shared trust, respect, or love. Reluctant to choose between being loyal to a group and being loyal to themselves, but lacking that deeper spiritual connection to shared humanity, they were far more aware of the pressure to fit in and conform. What was counterintuitive for me as I identified the main concerns is that a deeper sense of belonging and connection to a larger humanity gives people more freedom to express their individuality without fear of jeopardizing belonging. It's like, I can be myself when I know that I'm with people who recognize the inextricable, unnameable spiritual connection that is shared humanity, because belonging's not in jeopardy. So I'm going to read that to you again because it took me a long time to understand what people were saying. When I look at the main concerns from that study for Braving the Wilderness, people felt like when they had a deeper sense of belonging, and that belonging was tied to kind of a connection to larger humanity, that they had more freedom to be different without the fear of being socially rejected. They felt like they could be themselves with people who recognize that even if we're different and we believe different things and have different ideology, we're inextricably connected. So all of this research in Braving the Wilderness led me to really see that true belonging doesn't require us to change who we are. It requires us to be who we are. Our yearning for belonging is so hardwired that we often try to acquire it by any means possible, including trying to fit in and hustling for approval and acceptance. Not only are these efforts hollow substitutes for belonging, but they are the greatest barriers to belonging. When we work to fit in and be accepted, our belonging is tenuous. If we do or say something that's true to who we are, but outside the expectations or rules of the group, we risk everything. If people don't really know who we are and what we believe or think, there's actually no true belonging. Because we can feel belonging only if we have the courage to share our most authentic selves with people, our sense of belonging can never be greater than our level of self-acceptance. We can never truly belong if we're betraying ourselves, our ideals, or our values in the process. That's why it's a mistake to think that belonging is passive and simply about joining or going along with others. It's not. Belonging is a practice that requires us to be vulnerable, to get uncomfortable, and learn how to be present with people without sacrificing who we are. When we sacrifice who we are, we not only feel separate from others, but we even feel disconnected from ourselves. Many years ago, I asked a large group of eighth graders to break into small teams and come up with the differences between fitting in and belonging. I've shared these findings in a couple of books, and they still take my breath away. Let's go through some of them. One student said, belonging is being somewhere where you want to be, and they want you. Fitting in is being somewhere where you want to be, but they don't really care one way or the other. Another student said, belonging is being accepted for you. Fitting in is being accepted for being like everyone else. This is the one I think about all the time and talk to my kids about all the time. Are you ready? If I get to be me, I belong. If I have to be like you, I fit in. The conversations with these kids, I can't even tell y'all. I mean, this is currency of the realm in middle school and high school and probably life. But in middle school, I think it feels life and death for these kids. At some point, the conversation evolved and we started talking about other forms of belonging and not belonging. And I want to share some of the things that the kids said. So one of the students stood up and said, you know, not belonging at school is really hard, but it's nothing compared to what it feels like when you don't belong at home, when you don't live up to your parents' expectations. Another child offered not being as cool or popular as your parents want you to be. Another student said not being good at the same things your parents were good at. Another offering, your parents being embarrassed because you don't have enough friends or you're not an athlete or a cheerleader. Another student said your parents not liking who you are and what you like to do. There was another student who said when your parents don't even pay attention to your life. As you can hear and probably feel as I share these with you, these students understand the differences in their bones. Again, for many tweens and teens, belonging or not belonging feels like life or death. As a child, I never felt like I belonged in my family. I felt different as an introvert in my family, where introversion was mistaken for weakness and extroversion was mistaken for confidence. I also felt weird and alone in my small world because nothing was normalized. There were no conversations or TikToks about the unsaid stuff, how emotions can be overwhelming, how bodies work, how relationships can suck, how parents just don't understand, how normal people are lonely. I thought something was wrong with me. My feelings of not belonging are still something that I have to work on. They can still show up in weird ways when I'm not expecting it. What's so powerful, and to be honest with you, hard, is that the more my siblings and I talk about and share our experiences, the more I think everyone in my family felt the same way, a little on the outside of the myth of what we were supposed to be. I have a lot of empathy and compassion for my parents. They came from hardscrabble, working-class families where addiction and mental health issues were rarely addressed, and there wasn't enough money to cover them up with shiny things. I can only imagine the pictures of suburban perfection that drove their pain as kind of first-generation professionals and drove, honestly, their fury. As a parent, my goal is to help my children believe in and belong to themselves and to know that no matter what, I mean, no matter what, they always belong at home, that we see them and love them for who they are. The pressure to fit in is real and unrelenting, but if we can create that sense of inextricable connection, it's a fierce protector as they navigate belonging. Be here, be you, belong. Let's talk about belonging uncertainty. In the research, belonging uncertainty is the term sometimes used to describe questioning one's social belongingness. Belonging uncertainty can be high among members of marginalized groups, and this can have real consequences. For example, among underrepresented students at mainstream academic organizations, belonging uncertainty can have a negative impact on motivation and achievement. As we think about belonging uncertainty, it's important to remember that belonging is not about the number of friends one has in a space. According to researchers Gregory Walton and Shannon T. Brady, quote, "It is a more general inference drawn from cues, events, experiences, and relationships about the quality of fit or potential fit between oneself and a setting. It is experienced as a feeling of being accepted, included, respected in, and contributing to a setting or anticipating the likelihood of developing this feeling." God, that's so important. You know, it's so important. I think I'm going to read it to you again. This is Gregory Walton and Shannon T. Brady, researchers, defining belonging uncertainty. "It's a more general inference drawn from cues, events, experiences, and relationships about the quality of fit or potential fit between oneself and a setting. It is experienced as a feeling of being accepted, included, respected in, and contributing to a setting, or anticipating the likelihood of developing this feeling." Paola Sanchez-Valdez is our organization's first postgraduate social work fellow. She joined us right after completing her master's degree in social work from Columbia University. She's on the research team for this book and is helping us develop a strategy to bring Dare to Lead training to first-generation college students at the University of Texas at Austin. She has shared a lot with me and others about her experiences of belonging uncertainty, and I asked her if she would write something for the book. Then I asked her if she would read her story to you, and she said yes.
I was 10 years old when my mother confirmed what I knew all along. We were watching the 2006 immigration reform protests unfold on the news